Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is philosopher Roger Scruton, author of more than 30 books, including several novels, and the composer of two operas. Starting his academic career as a philosopher of aesthetics, Scruton emerged as a major voice for traditional conservatism in Britain with The Meaning of Conservatism in 1980. He's published a steady stream of works explicating both modern philosophy and his brand of traditional conservatism since then. His most recent book is titled How to Think Seriously About the Planet, The Case for an Environmental Conservatism. Roger, I'm so glad to have you on Counterpoint.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Roger, your conversion to conservatism happened in Paris in May 1968, when you witnessed how students and workers joined with intellectuals and artists to effect the largest strikes in French history. This uprising provoked in you a question for those rebellious youth animating it, which you state as follows. What do they propose to put in the place of this bourgeoisie whom they so despise and to whom they owe the freedom and prosperity that enable them to play on their toy barricades? You turn for insight to Edmund Burke, whose Reflections on the Revolution in France, written in 1790, in the midst of the French Revolution, is arguably the Bible for informed conservatives. Take us back to the late 1960s in France and how reading Burke and how studying for the bar and becoming a lawyer shaped some of the key axioms for your conservative vision.
Well, remember that I was in Paris as a foreigner who'd come from a very English education in which I had studied not only philosophy, but the classics of English literature and some measure of music, history, and so on. I had a kind of vision of cultural continuity, which was very precious to me. That's what my university, Cambridge, taught me that actually cultural continuity really matters because it helps you to identify not only who you are, but who you want to be with. And it was defined, as it were, independently of all these power relations that were being played out in the streets in Paris. But in Paris, of course, I encountered a very different thing. People of my generation didn't have that sense of cultural continuity. They were very much brought up in the Marxist tradition to see all of society as organized by class tensions and class struggles. People who belong to one class having control over people who belong to another. And this kind of way of seeing things, which I think of as a myth, had really penetrated the French intellectual establishment at that time, and was taught to students not only by the universities, but by the things that they were reading, in particular people like Michel Foucault, whose book, which I think is called The Order of Things in English, actually gave a new way of animating that old Marxist vision. And I think that's what brought the students together on the barricades in the streets and what inspired them. They all also were very much influenced by Sartre, and by this idea that there will be an alliance between the intellectuals and the proletariat which will overthrow the bourgeois order. Now, the first thing that struck me was that was a complete myth, that the workers, the working classes, insofar as you could witness them on the streets, were on the other side of the barricade. They were the policemen who were receiving the bricks being thrown at them by the students. You know, those were the real workers, and the students were in the business of smashing up the cars which people of working class origins had spent all their savings on acquiring. So I felt that this myth was incredibly destructive in its way of actually dividing the people it pretended to be uniting.
So how did you turn to Burke, and what intellectual nourishment did you find there?
Burke obviously was responding to a previous episode in Paris and to the French Revolution of 200 years before, but nevertheless bringing to it the same kind of settled English skepticism that I had. I think the French Revolution awoke him also to what he fundamentally believed, which is that there are no geometrical, rational solutions to the problems of human society. You can't lay down a blueprint and then conscript everyone to follow it. Such reason as there is in a social order emerges from the free interaction of individual brains and can't be contained in any one of them. That was the thought that I think is very important in the Reflections on the French Revolution, and it seemed to me absolutely pertinent to what was going on around me.
And there's also an aspect of earlier European traditional conservatism that you turn to in that moment, which has to do with a defense of authority and a defense of tradition. Can you talk a little bit more about those notions in your thinking?
Yes. I suppose that there are two approaches to this. There's essentially the English and American approach, which is embodied in T.S. Eliot, both as a critic and as a poet, in which tradition is something not made explicit, but as it were, there in the folds of society, something which you have to open your heart to and it flows through you. But then there's the French approach, which is typical of someone like de Maistre, in which tradition is made explicit and becomes a kind of guiding light. This is what we are, and this is how we must manifest ourselves in the public sphere. And I obviously was much more attached to that first British notion. And I guess it was the French idea of tradition which had, as it were, let the French down. Making things explicit is probably the greatest mistake that conservatives make.
There's also another aspect of these conservative thinkers that you seem to turn to, and I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about this, and that has to do with justification of prejudice. Can you speak a little bit about that?
That was Burke's word, and I think it's, of course, in the modern context, it's likely to be misinterpreted. What he meant was that people need prejudices in order to make clear, rational decisions that they can justify to themselves and to others. A prejudice meaning simply something which hasn't itself been the result of argument. It's the premise of the argument rather than the conclusion. And what Burke was saying is that everybody does need premises, and the habit of constantly questioning them will just leave people without the ability to take rational decisions. And I think in that sense, we do all need prejudices.
So I guess a better term is almost presuppositions.
Exactly, or foundations would be just as good. But he meant by foundations not something of an abstract geometrical kind, but something more like an instinct, a sense that this is the right way to go, that that's the wrong way to go, and so on.
And so part of what you were reacting against in these early and formative years was the willingness to sort of throw all of this out the window, along with the government and the institutions of power at the time, to sort of wipe the slate clean in order to create something new in the light of a pre-programmed formula for what the future ought to be if it was to be more just and equal, and that's what you rejected.
Yeah, well, that's a very good way of putting it. I suppose I would add a slight nuance here, that my own thinking about these things came from a sense that the past is always more important than the future, because the past can be known and the future cannot be known. Of course, there's another asymmetry. The past cannot be changed and the future can. But to change things without knowing what you're doing seemed to me to be the worst form of mistake.
And so at the very least, we can say that a central aspect of conservatism for you is conserving the past. Now, your early work was strongly critical not only of socialism, as you've already intimated, but of all forms of liberalism, including neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. This meant that you sought to disentangle conservatism from its mantras that were becoming de rigueur at the time of Thatcher and Reagan. That is, the talk of individualism and freedom, and especially reliance on market-driven solutions for everything, and a new religion of free enterprise and capitalism, something we hear a fair bit about in conservative circles in America today. What do you see as the shortcomings of the market and of unbridled free enterprise?
Wow, this is a huge question. It's absolutely true. In that book, I tried to distance conservatism from what you just called neoliberalism, the idea that you can create a complete social philosophy on the basis of individual freedom alone. And I still adhere to that. My basic feeling is that individual freedom only makes sense in the context of a community, because it's not something that you have in the state of nature. We become free. We become free through our relations with others. And only some kinds of relations suffice to make us free. Some won't do that. And I take great strength from Hegel's arguments in this matter, where he, in many places, but especially in the Phenomenology of Spirit, tries to show how the individual gains his freedom only through relations of recognition, mutual recognition with others, from which institutions naturally grow. If your freedom, however, starts threatening those institutions, it's also threatening itself. And I think that is the main problem with what might be called unbridled capitalism. by which one means individual freedom taken as the sole relevant consideration in political decisions, in which institutions are arbitrarily swept away because they seem to stand in the way of it. And I think we've seen that with institutions of education, institutions of law, very basic social traditions that in medical practice and ordinary interrelation at the local level, which have been swept away by things like multinationals that have no concern with them.
Roger, we've been speaking in very broad and general and abstract terms, and I want to zero in a little bit on how this applies to some concrete issues. And in order to do that, I want to do something that is somewhat preposterous, which is to ask you to very quickly run through how you understand certain issues, which you've written whole books about. But give it to us in a nutshell, where you come down on certain things. Let's start by talking a little bit about issues like, for example, animal rights. Mm. What's wrong with those rights?
I take the view that to have rights, you must also have duties. Rights aren't cost-free. The cost of having a right is that you have a duty towards others, in particular, a duty towards others who you are asking to uphold that right. And the language of right and duty is something which we human beings have developed in order to live by negotiated relations with each other. We confer on each other a kind of sphere of sovereignty, which is defined by our rights, and from that sphere we can negotiate freely the solutions to our competitive interactions. Animals don't live that way. They are in competition with each other, but they don't negotiate solutions in quite that way. They don't grant each other sovereignty. They don't have duties towards each other. If we try and nevertheless consider them as the beneficiaries of rights, we're going to have to start thinking of them as full moral beings, just like ourselves. And the result would not be treating them well. It would be treating them in a way which defies their nature.
So at least part of the kernel of that is that in animal rights, you have such an explosion of the notion of rights that you're extending it to all sorts of beings. What's your short take on the rise of feminism and concurrent shifts in sexual norms?
This, of course, is a huge question in America and increasingly in the rest of the world. I guess I take the view that feminism in its origins was a perfectly natural and right reaction to the change in social structures that had gone on as a result of the Industrial Revolution, the moving of women into the workforce, and the change in the nature of the family. And all these changes are huge, and it was necessary to reorient the relation between man and woman to accommodate them. And I think that's what early feminists were trying to do, and to claim their role in public life and in the political process, which would, as it were, legitimize these new relations between man and woman. But I think there's another kind of feminism which I find rather disturbing, which involves a kind of repudiation of the male principle, an attempt to deny that men can have a sphere of their own, deny that men and women are fundamentally different in lots of respects, and also to accuse men always of being exploiters or manipulators when they are trying simply to reaffirm what they fundamentally are.
And to turn to yet another vast topic, another one that you've written a whole book about, but that we hear a lot about in the contemporary post-9/11 context. What about globalization and the terrorist threat?
I suppose the way I look at it is this, that we can't accept all the things that we think we must accept from the globalizing of the economy and the globalizing of communications and so on, and also not accept with it the transfers of populations from one part of the world to another, and also the ease of travel of people who have debts of vengeance, so to speak, to settle around the world. I think when it comes to the threat to America, what one has to remember is that the real fundamental cause of terrorism is not a just grievance against somebody who's harmed you. It's a resentment against someone who's more successful than you. America is manifestly successful in so many different ways that she is naturally the target of resentment. Wherever that resentment might happen to originate, it will end up targeting America. And because of all of the mobility and the globalization that America is partly responsible for, it becomes very easy to target America. It's very easy to create myths about what has been done, deprive you of your rights and so on. And then you do have inevitably this terrorist threat.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with renowned conservative philosopher and writer Roger Scruton. Well, Roger, I really appreciate that you've been willing to talk both about the very big picture and some of your abstract ideas and then zero in on some specific ways in which this plays out. Now I want to drill a little bit deeper, and let us now turn to how to think seriously about the planet and your case for environmental conservatism. Your opening gambit in the book is to insist that within the history of environmentalism, in Britain, America, France, and Germany, it was hardly only leftists who saw this as a central concern. Remind us of how environmental concerns developed historically as a cause that was endorsed by both the left and the right.
Let's just think about England for a moment. The environmental movement really was inseparable from the, first of all, the Enlightenment and the rise of the Romantic movement in the arts, where people began looking around themselves, first of all, for something that they could regard as precious and holy and their duty to safeguard. That was the Romantic movement in painting and in poetry, entirely inspired by that. And of course, our leading Romantic poet, William Wordsworth, was also a founder of the active environmental movement in the beginning of the 19th century with his campaign against the railroad and so on. His disciple, John Ruskin, who identified himself as a Tory, set up these small institutions of people, getting people together to protect their immediate environment from the worst ravages of the industrial process, and at the same time trying to influence people to build their new cities as genuine human habitats and not just as great sprawls. And those are major environmental motives today. They started, in my view, in the 18th century and became totally active and coherent in the 19th. You have similar things, not quite the same, but the growth of the wilderness movement in America during the course of the 19th century was again an attempt to protect a valuable environment in which people of basically conservative disposition got together to say, look, this is precious, let's keep it.
You clearly share some of the same concerns of these traditional romantics and those who were part of the wilderness movement, but you also share some of the concerns of the environmental movement. While you caution, for example, against global alarmism, you agree that the environment is one of the central problems of our time. You agree, as you write, that without the resources of government, it's hard to address such problems as climate change, oil spills, plastic pollution, and the loss of biodiversity. You also agree that consumerism, instant gratification, and the fast food nation, as well as multinationals with nothing at stake in the polis, are central to the problem. So tell us then, what is wrong with the environmental movement as it stands now?
The environmental movement as it stands now is obviously not one thing, but the first thing I want to say that is wrong with it is it involves an attempt to globalize the problem in such a way that people no longer feel able to act in the sphere which they have. You know, we all of us can act in our own local sphere, know how to do it, but when the problem is, as it were, confiscated from that sphere and redefined as something which can only be done at the international level, people lose heart and say, in that case, you know, I don't know what to do. And they put all their efforts into signing treaties which everybody knows will never be obeyed anyway. So the thing fizzles out. I think that's a major problem, this diversion of attention away from the sphere of action which is available to us to one which is not available to us. But I also think that there's a tendency in the environmental movement to demonize specific people like oil companies or, you know, motor car companies and so on, who are, of course, doing things which damage the environment. But they're doing things which damage the environment because people want their products. You know, and you can't just address it by demonizing one part of the whole thing. You have to aim at creating another way of life in which people don't want these products quite as much as they do now.
So on the one hand, the global as opposed to local aspects of it. On the other hand, the ways in which corporations in particular, certain kinds of corporations in particular, tend to be demonized. You say a fair bit, though, about problems also of the way in which the solutions to the problem can't be handled by NGOs or only by status solutions. Can you amplify your concerns there a little bit
more? Yes. I think many of the big environmental NGOs like Earth First and Greenpeace and so on act as though it's sufficient to target governments and put pressure on them to change their policy while themselves exhibiting the very problems that cause our environmental catastrophes. An NGO of that kind is not itself answerable to anyone. It doesn't have a structure of self-criticism. It doesn't have members who can say, that, you know, thou shalt not do this. if it makes a mistake, I give some examples in the book, if it makes a mistake, it can just go on and make the next mistake. In other words, the lack of accountability that is the major cause of environmental problems in multinational business is there in multinational NGOs as well.
Can you give us an example? Because that would be very helpful. So you talk about the unintended consequences of some environmental action.
A very good example is the disposal of the Brent Spar oil platform in the North Sea, which the Greenpeace said this must not be done, it's environmental catastrophe, and agitated so that the thing had to be taken apart in a Norwegian fjord at enormous expense and damaged Shell's reputation and so on. And then it was discovered it contained no oil, and this was the best thing would have been to have sunk it in the sea as Shell proposed. This didn't lead to any attempt to compensate Shell, of course, nor did it lead to any change of behavior. Greenpeace just said, sorry, we'll go on to the next campaign. And you find this in all kinds of environmental campaigns. The campaign against the seal cull in Canada that's been, quite a few NGOs have been engaged in, done completely without any accountability, either to the general public or especially to the Inuit communities who suffer from it.
But nonetheless, your call in this book is for an environmentalism. So let's talk a little bit more about what you are calling for. The heart of the program for conservative environmentalism and conservation is what you call oikophilia, the love and feeling for home. Can you explain what you mean by this notion and why it's central for why conservatives can actually be more successful for solving the problems of the environment than leftists and liberals?
Well, I don't want to deny that leftists and liberals make their contribution, of course, because they do, and they too can have this motive. What I do want to say, though, is that the environmental movement can't really get going until it has identified a motive in ordinary people that can be called upon when we want them to change their life, to change their preferences, and to do it by consent. And there is a motive, and that's why I identify oikophilia as that motive. It's the motive that we all have, which is implanted deep within us by evolution and also by interpersonal relations, both to create a home and to look after it, and to welcome strangers into it, and to also to cooperate with those building home nearby. That's the thought that I have, and I think that if we explore this motive, we can see how it can be used to protect our immediate environment and gradually expanded to protect further reaches of our environment. This is one reason why I'm hostile to much leftist thinking in the book, namely that leftists on the whole, especially in Europe, have been hostile to the nation state, which in my view is the largest expansion that the oikophilia has ever had. It's never going to expand to cover the whole world, but here is a pretty good example of people trying to protect as much of their environment as possible.
So the way you put it in the book is you say, I defend local initiatives against global schemes, civil association against political activism, and small-scale institutions of friendship against large-scale and purpose-driven campaigns. Carolyn Lucas responded to your book. She's the Green Party MP. She wrote in a review of your book the following, and I'd like to get your response to what she said. The argument that local, national, and global environmental challenges, I'm quoting her here, can be met by ordinary people acting alone, volunteering in their locality out of love for hearth and home, while the free market largely corrects itself, is pure fantasy. How do you respond to this critique?
Well, first of all, she's making two points. One is that this kind of local oikophilia is never going to be enough. And my view is that is probably true, but it is something. And it also it means that it helps us to start somewhere. And it is what governments can appeal to when they want to do something bigger. If they just do something bigger without appealing to any motive, then their policies will never be actually pursued by the individuals that they want to change. So I think that she's wrong in thinking that because it's limited, it doesn't actually do the job. The other thing she says is that it's a fantasy to think of the free market as self-correcting. I don't think the free market is always self-correcting, but I think people have a wrong view about it. What I actually want to say is that the free market is not a genuine free market where people can externalize their costs. That's what we've seen growing through the global corporation. Not a genuine market, because a genuine market is one where the benefits of an action are paid for by the costs of it, by the single person whose action it is. What we have seen is something quite different, where people take the benefits of an action and transfer the costs. That is not a market. a real market is a kind of, as I call it, a homeostatic system, something which, when it goes wrong, responds with some corrective movement, some feedback.
But I'm just wondering, I mean, in that sense, has a free market ever existed historically?
Like all these things, it's an ideal towards which things have tended more at one point than at another. And we are used to this because we are used to legislation which compels people to internalize their costs. You know, a very good example is the plastic bottle. A law which says that if you issue drinks in plastic bottles, you must also put a charge on that bottle, which is repaid to the person when it's handed back to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer then has the cost of disposing of it. There, you've very quickly rectified something and internalized the cost and restored a kind of market equilibrium. And also, from an environmental point of view, that's the obvious solution.
So if I can say, there are two sides to the way in which you address the problem. One is your call is for insisting that environmentalism pays a lot of attention to why it is that individuals themselves ought to care deeply about the environmental cause more generally, right? Not just the activists in the movement, but all of us should think about the world that we live in and the home that we have and what that environment entails within it. Then as we think about the problem within larger scales that go beyond just our domicile, but we think about the home at least to the borders of the nation state, that we can think about the ways in which markets do have aspects of correction built within them. And so we can target then legislation that
it restores that equilibrating mechanism. Yeah.
Well, Roger Scruton, thank you so much for being with us today on Counterpoint to discuss something that I think for some people might come across as a paradox, but that you've really helped us bring together, and that is conservatism and environmentalism.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally. Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.